Hi, Ben.
Hi, how are you? Oh, thanks for having me. I
What's good?
appreciate it.
What do you see as the differences between you and the other conservative intellectuals such as Jordan Peterson, Dave Rubin, Sam Harris, and Dennis Prager?
Well, I mean, each one of those, there are some differences. Right? If you look at the difference between me and Jordan, Jordan is less a political commentator than he is sort of a philosopher. And so I agree with some of Jordan's philosophy, disagree with Jordan's some of Jordan's philosophy, but he certainly has a sort of different audience and maybe a slightly broader audience for the kind of stuff that he pitches. Dave Rubin is somebody who was on the left. He is now considered on the right and is sort of libertarian minded. So we actually agree on a lot of politics, but our life stories are obviously very different. I'm much more socially conservative than he is, much more religious than Dave is. If you mentioned Sam Harris, so Sam, I would say, is more anti-woke than he is certainly conservative. He's voted Democrat consistently, voted against President Trump, for example. He and I share very little in the way of actual policy prescriptions. I think we just share a large-scale distaste for willingness by others to shut down conversation, although Sam seems to be somewhat more resistant to talk about that sort of stuff lately. So there are always differences between political commentators, for sure.
You think that your being religious affects your policies that you want to adopt and you want to implement in American civil life?
I'm not sure that my religious beliefs affect per se my policy prescriptions. I think that religious beliefs provide a fundamental bedrock for values, and values affect policy. So I would say it's a little more indirect than that. It's not like I keep kosher, therefore I want everybody in America to keep kosher, or I am a believer in a sexually traditional lifestyle, therefore I want everybody else to be a believer in a traditional sexual lifestyle, and therefore the government must step in. I actually don't think the government really has a place in either of those places, for example. But I do think that the root values that I hold that do draw from religion, personal responsibility, the ability of human beings to freely choose, the necessity of granting people freedom to practice their religion, the importance of social bounds and social norms outside of government, a lot of that does spring from the importance of religion in my life.
In the past, you've recommended that college students follow your example of telling intolerant professors what they want to hear. Jordan Peterson, on the other hand, recommended telling the truth because it is better for your psyche and your soul to accustom yourself to being brave and to being honest. Have you changed your mind?
I haven't. I think that there is a this goes to almost a Kantian categorical imperative question, right? Is it always better not to fib? And so I'm not sure what Jordan would say to that. Is it always better in every situation not to fib? I mean, presumably Jordan would disagree and would say there are certain circumstances in which it is beneficial to lie to people who are bad, for example, right? The famous example with regard to Kant always suggested, of course, that you couldn't lie ever. So the famous counterexample is the Nazis at your door. There's a Jew in your attic. What do you say to the Nazi when he says, is there a Jew in your attic? And so Kant presumably would say you'd have to tell the truth. I assume Jordan would not say the same. And so the question becomes, under what circumstances is it beneficial or useful to lie? And when does it compromise your fundamental central values? I don't think it compromises your central values to tell people who are dishonest that they ought not have control over your life. I think it is perfectly plausible to say that a professor who is not interested in hearing your genuine opinion and is actually testing your ability to regurgitate the information that he's given you, telling him what he wants to hear, which is exactly what he's looking for, I'm not sure how that is a compromise in values unless you actually are doing it publicly. I think it's one thing to repeat something publicly and in front of other people. It's another thing to give the professor what he wants on the test so you can get what you want on the test. I'm not sure how that's a massive compromise in values.
So do you think we should attempt to save academia and the mainstream media from its bias, or should we invest in other channels for research and information?
I think that we need to build alternatives. I think these institutions are too far gone. I don't think the universities are savable. I think alternative institutions will break them down. I think the internet is doing so. People are taking online classes. People are hiring without college degrees. And I think all of that is very good. The same thing is true in the media. And I think what you're starting to see is a shift toward a 501c3 charitable model for journalism, which makes a lot of sense because journalism is very, very expensive. And everybody cribs off journalism. It's not really a profit center. But when it comes to telling what the news means, that is a profit center. It can be a profit center, and you need a bunch of alternative sources to provide it. So I'm not going to count on the New York Times to moderate its opinions on a variety of viewpoints. What I am going to do is provide an alternative to people, which in many cases is as popular or more popular than The Times.
The Daily Wire has recently partnered with Gina Carano to produce a full-length movie. Do you have any plans for the future, films or series?
Oh, yeah. Well, so we have the Gina movie that is starting production in the next probably month, 6 weeks, something like that. And then we also have another movie that is going to be coming out next year that we're really excited about as well. We have a couple of TV series that we are starting to produce. We have all sorts of entertainment content that we're looking forward to releasing.
What's the importance of those series or films or cultural matters?
And the importance is in providing an alternative, just as we discussed with regard to media and just as we discussed with regard to other arenas, academia. Providing alternatives is really, really important. Hollywood right now has a monopoly on what people see and hear from an entertainment perspective, which means that, for example, Rachel Maddow of MSNBC, she didn't just re-sign a deal with MSNBC this week. She actually signed a deal that gives her an overall entertainment deal. So she's going to be producing movies now, for example. You're never going to see anything similar from the right, except for us. Right? Nobody is ever going to hire me to write movies for Hollywood or Karl Rove or would have Charles Krauthammer. Like, none of that was ever going to happen. But if you're on the left, this is all fairly well established, right? If you're Barack Obama, you get a movie deal. If you're Donald Trump, then you go home to Mar-a-Lago and everybody tries to prosecute you. So providing an alternative is a necessary expedient.
So basically, you're going to give a job for everyone that the left has canceled.
That's definitely one of our strategies. If the left continues to cancel popular people, just cancel them right over here and we'll pick them up and we're happy to make money off of them and provide our audiences with people that they want to hear and who are now being silenced.
Can you provide some tips and strategies of defending free speech against biased media and big tech?
So I think that it's a couple of different questions. So big tech and biased media are not quite the same thing. Biased media, again, providing the alternative is the best form of fighting back. And it turns out that these institutions destroy themselves if they even offer you an open door. Politico, for example, earlier this year offered me the ability to write the Politico playbook. That prompted such a strong revolt inside the newsroom that now the newsroom is going to unionize probably and maybe destroy Politico from the inside, which is hilarious to me, frankly. I think if that's the way they want it, that's the way they're going to get it. And I'm proud to lead the unionization efforts over at Politico. Meanwhile, when it comes to big tech, I think that there are a couple of things that can be done. One is there was an attempt to build alternatives with, for example, Parler. It seems to me at this point that there's a double game that's being played by big tech and government. So government has granted a specific subsidy to big tech. Right? That subsidy was designed in order, and not just big tech, to everybody. That subsidy was designed in order to broaden the mode of communication. The idea was that you're not responsible for the commentary in your comments section. So if your site like Facebook or Twitter is entirely a comment section, you're not responsible for any of the content there. Okay, fine. But there are also carve-outs from Section 230, Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which says that you're allowed to curate that content. Well, the question is, ideologically and intellectually speaking, when does curation become editing? Right? Over at Daily Wire, we edit, right? We hire people, we fire people, we decide which articles we want to print. We don't print all the articles we receive. Right? If that becomes the same sort of model over at Facebook or Twitter, not in terms of hiring and firing, but in terms of deciding what can go up and what can go down on the basis of politics, have they now violated the chief reason that Section 230 was created in the first place, which was to actually protect sites that wanted to get rid of, for example, pornographic material, but still wanted to have an open comment section? So the solution there is to get rid of the so-called catch-all language of Section 230. There's a catch-all provision of 230 that says you're allowed to remove material without incurring liability that is pornographic or obscene or abusive. And then it says, or otherwise objectionable. Just get rid of that phrase, otherwise objectionable. And now Facebook can't just get rid of things because it finds them politically offensive. And that would solve some of the problems. It would create liability for Facebook if, in fact, they did remove stuff on the basis of politics alone.
So if I understand you correctly, if you take this phrase off, so the recent regulation is okay. Like the regulation,
yes,
that is in the law.
It really helps. Yes. The regulation
goes with the classical liberal approach.
Yes. At that point, basically, you've said that Facebook is allowed to take stuff down that is, for example, pornographic or fully abusive, for example. But they're not allowed to take stuff down on the basis of politics. And if they do take stuff down on the basis of politics, their liability protections are now removed. So what that means is that if they take stuff down on the basis of politics, but they don't take down, for example, slanderous material, then they could be sued for the slanderous material, which makes sense because, again, either they're responsible for the stuff on their site or they're not responsible for the stuff on their site. The entire premise of these social media sites is they are not actually responsible for the stuff on their site. They can't claim responsibility for some and no responsibility for others.
Do you believe that Judaism has liberal foundations, or do you subscribe with the traditional view, claiming that Jewish values are closer to socialist principles?
I'm always sort of hard pressed to see where Jewish values are close to socialist principles. The only sort of halachic, you know, Jewish law related provisions of Judaism that seem socialistic are things like Yovel, which frankly the Rabbanim found a way around, or Shemitah, right, forgiveness of loans, which again they found a way around. And when it comes to land sales and reversion of land to tribes, that was a specific expedient. The tribes no longer exist, so that obviously is no longer really applicable. If you're talking about, you know, the sort of economic system set up by Judaism, Judaism is a very private property centric system, and the taxation system in Judaism, you know, between Maser and Maser Sheni and Truma and all of this, it amounts to essentially for most years somewhere between a 10 and 20% tax rate. That looks a lot more liberal than socialistic to me.
Why did you adopt the Christian stance when it comes to abortion? That means that when the baby is created in the womb, even in the first day, it already has a life like a human being.
Because the any alternative is illogical to me. So the sort of it is treated as water standard of the Talmud. First of all, that's not really true, right? It's not treated like nothing. You still have to get even halachically, you have to get a heter from a rabbi in order for you to go get an abortion, even before 40 days. And halachic authority is far greater than me, right? I'm not a halachic authority at all. Halachic authority is far greater than me, ranging from Rav Soloveitchik to Moshe Feinstein, were extraordinarily strict on abortion. So I don't think that what I'm saying is a radical departure from a huge swath of Jewish halachists. The kind of ideological standard that to me it's a life from the beginning as opposed to 40 days is just rooted in the sheer biology of the situation. And so if that comes into conflict with a sort of Talmudic principle that morally it's treated in a certain way beyond 40 days, you can argue about the morality of where it should be treated beyond 40 days. But on a scientific level, I fail to see how life doesn't start at conception, but does start at 40 days. There's no actual hard scientific evidence that backs that.
Yeah, but by halakha, even if someone is doing an abortion without a permit from a rabbi, it is considered chabalah, which means you hurt your body and you don't hurt someone else or some soul.
Well, I mean, so there's some pretty detailed debate over exactly how the baby is treated. And when you say that you're not hurting somebody's body or hurting somebody's soul, or that the soul is instantiated at the moment of exit from the womb, I find that just hard to support on a scientific basis. Now, again, I'm not a halachist. I don't think that halacha is the guide, as I've said at the very top of this interview, for what law ought to be. So I don't feel the need to justify my own political positions in terms of halacha, nor should anybody use me as a halacha guide. I'm not a rabbi and I don't have smicha. So if you want to ask a religious question to a rabbi, you should ask a religious question to a rabbi. If the idea is that every position that I take on public policy has to be more liberal than halakha, I don't see why that would particularly be the case.
Do you think there is a future for American Jewry concerning the last Pew research that found
out
that
the future for American Jewry is modern Orthodox Jewry and Orthodox Jewry? I mean, that's what the Pew research shows, right? What the Pew research shows is that a huge swath of people who are under the age of 40 and are Jewish in the United States are Orthodox, and nearly nobody above the age of 60 in the United States is Orthodox. What that shows is that young Orthodox people are remaining Jewish, and people who are not Orthodox are largely not over the course of one or two generations. Frankly, there's a similar problem demographically in Israel, although not nearly the same. There, the problem is childbirth rates as opposed to actual intermarriage. In the United States, the real problem is intermarriage in terms of Jewish numbers.
Yeah, but, you know, even in Israel, the secular Jews are giving birth per woman something like 2.3, 2.4, so we don't really have a problem.
Right, you know? So I'd like to see those numbers, because last I checked, the overall average in Israel is 2.2, right? I think the overall average is 2.2,
no,
2.
I think
3.
More. In the last years, we've gone really up.
That's great. I mean, first of all, that's great. I wish we in the United States had a replacement rate I mean, I think we may be barely at replacement rates in the United States. I don't think we are, actually. I think we've started to drop below replacement rates. But the demographic arguments I've heard from Israel is that people who are more Orthodox are having 8 kids, people who are secular are having 2 kids or 3 kids. And so over time, you're going to start to see more of a difficult sort of demographic argument in Israel between the Orthodox and the non-Orthodox. In the United States, you're certainly seeing that. You're seeing it much more in the Jewish community in the United States because that's exacerbated by intermarriage. Because secular Jews in the United States tend not to marry Jews and then don't tend to raise their children Jewish. So it doesn't tend to, so it really isn't a question of how many kids those secular Jews have. The question is whether those kids are even raised Jewish. That's not the same issue as in Israel.
Of course. Many of my listeners were wondering, have you ever considering doing Aliyah?
No, not particularly. So I love Israel. Israel is wonderful. I've considered buying real estate in Israel and bringing my kids there on a regular basis. America is my country and the country that I think has the finest constitutional principles on the planet.
And this is why you're there, because of principles. But I don't really get it, because usually for someone, belief is much stronger, or nationality, like Jewish nationality, is much more stronger than believing in some kind of values which are, you know, man-made. So.
Well, I mean, but I think that there's a lot of religious principles that undergird the Enlightenment principles of the Declaration of Independence and Constitution of the United States. And beyond that, even from a Jewish perspective, there's a notion that just Jewishly, there is there's a real importance to doing work on behalf of broader values, even if it takes you outside the land of Israel.
I wanted to ask you another question about the dual identity and the dual loyalty about the American Jewry, because many anti-Semitic voices have long claimed that the Jews hold dual identity and dual loyalty. Do you agree about it?
I'm not sure. When people say that Jews hold dual loyalty, I guess my question would be, in the same way as Cuban Americans hold dual loyalty, or in the same way that Irish Americans hold dual loyalty, or in the same way Italian Americans hold dual loyalty, right? Meaning, are there things that we believe about the importance of foreign lands that have an impact on American policy? Absolutely. So what? I don't understand what, like, when they come into conflict, the question is going to be over what issue do they come into conflict? So far I've seen there are times when I believe that the United States has been more right than Israel on a particular issue. There are times when I believe that Israel is more right than the United States on a particular issue. So I'm not sure what the dual loyalty argument is, unless the two nations went to war, in which case you'd actually have to pick a side, which of course is not going to happen.
Yeah, but when the American interest of maybe defending Israel, or the American interest of not defending Israel, like it could clash.
Frankly, I don't believe that the two come into conflict any more than Catholic Americans, you know, have dual loyalty to the Pope and have dual loyalty to the United States. Right? It's very interesting to me that in sort of American politics, the only accusation of dual loyalty that people even bother to take seriously is the accusation against Jews of dual loyalty. There are a bajillion dual identities in the United States, people who have multiple layers of identity ranging from the tribal to the religious to the international. And yet the only appropriate forum for these questions is always directed against Jews, which I find interesting.
Yeah. Do you believe that Israel could exist without the American support?
I think increasingly, yes. I think that at the beginning, no. I think that right now, honestly, it's a question for the Defense Department in Israel. But as far as, you know, Israel's role in the world, as Israel has a more and more solid economy, as Israel provides more and more tech, as Israel becomes more and more self-reliant in terms of its own military capacity, the answer is going to be increasingly yes. And I'm as an American, I'm rooting for it. And as a fan of Israel, I'm rooting for it. So as a Zionist, I'm rooting for it. So I think that, you know, I would love to see Israel be fully independent in the same way that I'd love to see, you know, Europe be fully independent of American spending on defense in Europe. The fact is that Europe lived off the largesse of the United States for nearly the entire Cold War period. So I'm very much in favor of everybody sort of, you know, being self-sufficient. So I think Israel is getting more self-sufficient. The best thing that Israel could do is dramatically lower its business tax rate and take advantage of the increasingly unfriendly international business climate. And Israel has such unbelievable levels of intellectual capital that Israel would start making a fortune pretty quickly. And what world politics shows is that economic and military power are a lot more important. People tend to follow that much more than their supposed principles.
Do you think that American Jews benefit from Israel's existence? And if so, how?
I mean, of course, American Jews, I mean, I think Jews everywhere benefit from Israel's existence for a wide variety of reasons, including the fact that when things go bad, Jews have a place to go. That is an extraordinarily important thing, as we've seen from world history. Also, the aggression against Jews in foreign countries is there's an actual body to push back against that. The reality that there is a Jewish state is of great international importance in terms of Jews not just being treated as a internal minority to be batted about, but there being external forces that can actually come and work to defend Jews, which Israel has done all over the world. So, yes, I think there's been heavy benefit to American Jews and to Jews globally from this. And right now, because America is very kind to the Jews and very good for the Jews, I would say more clear benefit to, for example, French Jews right now than to American Jews in the existence of Israel. But that doesn't mean that Israel is somehow not valuable to American Jews. I think that all the Jews who have historically thought that the lack of a Jewish state is no problem, it's not gone particularly great.
In light of your answer, do you think that the Jews that live in the diaspora have a moral obligation to join the IDF for a certain amount of time?
I don't think that Jews who live in the diaspora have a moral obligation to join the IDF because they're citizens of the countries in which they live. But I think that they do have a moral, and if they are Jews who identify as Jews, I do think that they have a moral duty to support Israel on an ideological level.
Mm-hmm. You know, much of the efforts of the BDS movement and other anti-Israel organizations is concerned on turning international public opinion against Israel by spreading disinformation regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. We saw an example of that on a recent episode of Joe Rogan podcast, where Joe hosted a BDS activist, Abby Martin, who presented a twisted image of the conflict by telling blunt lies. What strategy should Israel and its supporters adopt in order to fight such anti-Israel propaganda?
You debunk those lies where you can. I'm happy to talk with Joe about those issues. I'm going to be on his show sometime in the near future, and hopefully that will come up. As far as debunking anti-Israel lies, obviously a lot of time should be spent on that. But it seems to me that the real point of contention has always been for Israel that when it comes to BDS and the anti-Israel push, Israel spends an awful lot of time back-footed, meaning that Israel spends an awful lot of time defending itself by talking about its human rights record, which is excellent, and talking about the challenges that Israel faces in the face of terror, which of course is true. But the reality is that the Palestinians, the Palestinian Authority, its advocates, Hamas, their advocates, they spend no time at all talking about their own domestic treatment of their citizens or about their treatment of Jews. They spend all of their time just talking about how their enemies are evil and their enemies need to be destroyed. And you'll notice that BDS activists never spend one iota of time talking about the behavior of Hamas or the behavior of the Palestinian Authority. They spend all of their time talking about the supposed evils of Israel in a complete vacuum. There's something similar that happens in the United States with regard to critiquing American foreign policy. There's an awful lot of time that's spent on critiquing American foreign policy without regard to who the United States is fighting. So you saw for 20 years, all of this talk about the evils of the United States and their predations in Afghanistan. The minute that the United States leaves, then all of a sudden people realize, oh, wait a second. When the U.S. leaves, the Taliban fills the gap. Israel needs to spend nearly all of its time doing what it has refused to do, really, since Oslo, and that is tell the truth about Palestinian Authority, tell the truth about Hamas, tell the truth about Hezbollah, and spend an awful lot of time and resources informing the public about what it is that Israel faces. Because when people are given the full picture of the conflict, they're going to realize that, of course, Israel makes mistakes because every country makes mistakes. But they're also going to realize that Israel faces an implacable foe and a series of them that pose an existential threat to the state of Israel literally every day. And those people can never be allowed to gain additional power in the system. In fact, every time Israel has attempted to give these people power within the system, they've promptly, as in the case of the Gaza Strip, elected terrorist groups.
So like in other fields, you are on the attack.
Yeah, I mean, I think that being on the defensive is usually the first step toward losing.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on Israel Defense Service law requiring mandatory conscription?
Mandatory conscription without religious exemptions, you mean?
To an extent, you know, but in Israel, ultra-Orthodox Jews get to be exempt.
Yes, I'm fully in favor of everybody who is an Israeli citizen paying taxes being given national service requirements.
Do you have a solution for the Arab community in Israel, like that not right now they are excluded of being drafted to the army?
I mean, the solution would be some form of national service in the same way that there's a solution that's provided to, you know, Haredim who prefer a national service. And if people don't wish to do the national service, then it seems to me that the loyalty to the state is in serious question. The United States still has people. You still have to register for selective service in the United States.
And anybody is being drafted, or is just something that...
No, but if a draft were to kick in, you'd be subject to the draft. It's not as though you would be able to simply say, well, I'm, you know, there are rare conscientious objectors in times of war in the United States, but Israel's in a consistent state of war, so that's a bit of a different story.
Yeah. One of the biggest issues we have in Israel is that a large chunk of the decision-making process is put in the hand of bureaucrats and unelected government officials. On occasion, they make decision independent of elected politicians and the will of the people. They also invent complicated system to elect themselves without outside intervention, allowing them freedom from accountability. What are your thoughts on this subject?
I mean, we have the same problem in the United States, and it's one of the great evils of bureaucratic systems. It should be ended forthwith. And unaccountable bureaucracies are the worst aspect of regulatory democracies. And they lead to dissatisfaction with the policy. They often lead to bad policy. They lead to regulatory capture by institutions that are outside the bureaucracy but work with the bureaucracy. And again, they are insulated from the feedback loop that democracy usually provides. I'm wholly against bureaucracies, whether you're talking about public health bureaucracies or whether you're talking about educational bureaucracies. Any sort of administrative bureaucracy that is unanswerable to the public is extraordinarily dangerous to democracy.
It's really weird that America have gone this far because, like, the American system is based on a system which the president is electing few thousand people to be the heads of the bureaucracy. So how did it happen in America? In Israel, we have a whole different system which the bureaucracies are staying in their place. So what happened to America?
I mean, the story of what happened here really goes back to the beginning of the 20th century when Woodrow Wilson and Teddy Roosevelt basically decided that the administration of a central government was to be done by experts. And there started to be the creation of these executive agencies. Congress would create an executive branch agency, which would be permanently staffed by a group of bureaucratic experts. And then these agencies would be funded by Congress. The idea was that if Congress ever got too unhappy with the agency, it would defund that. But Congress is never in the business of defunding anything.
Yeah.
And that's particularly true of bureaucratic agencies, which are constantly granted more and more money, because here's the problem. Bureaucratic agencies intentionally are created in order to, as I say, insulate from the feedback loop. And also they are created in order to pander to particular populations. So what you have with the case of most of these bureaucratic institutions is very acute and focused benefits and very diffuse harms. So you have a specific group of people who are very much helped by, for example, the Bureau of Indian Affairs or Bureau of Native American Affairs in the United States, and a diffuse group of people, namely the American taxpayers, who are harmed by spending billions of dollars on programs that don't make a whole hell of a lot of sense. Well, if those harms are diffuse enough, it's very hard to argue against them. And this has been the case in America, for sure.
In interviews you gave for your recent book, The Authoritarian Moment, you gave an example of how the left forces the surrender of the center to the left. Let's say that a girl in a family becomes vegetarian and the mother cooks veggie for all the family. And then they have a neighborhood barbecue, and then the whole neighborhood is eating veggie because of one girl. So in your view, if we insist on our beliefs, we can affect those who are neutral to our side, since most people follow along rather than seriously study ideologies. But this solution doesn't necessarily work when the left controls power centers like academia, government bureaucracies, and teachers' union. Imagine what would the teachers' union do to a teacher, even if he has friends who are going with him, if he says something he shouldn't have been said by the politically correct.
That's 100% right. I mean, there are certain institutions that are unfixable. I'm not talking about how you fix a teachers union from the inside. Frankly, I'm for the abolition of teachers unions. So I think that what you actually have to do in those particular cases is move to change the regulations surrounding the certification of unions. And there have been those sorts of moves inside the United States in a wide variety of states. And so I'm very much in favor of breaking the power of teachers unions, which are essentially government-created monopolies. When you're talking about other institutions, like institutions, basically there are three categories of institutions. Ones you don't have to worry about because they're neutral or conservative. Ones that have recently been made woke by the power of renormalization. And the third is institutions that are beyond repair, which just need to be completely wrecked. And I think that some of the institutions you're mentioning, teachers unions, for example, or you mentioned academia, I think it's very difficult to see how those institutions recover. You need to do it through competition. Or if these are institutions that have been set up by special regulatory tools, you have to get rid of the actual regulatory tools.
The left have much catchier slogans, appeals better to emotions and think of itself as morally superior. Right-wing positions, on the other hand, require that the average person concentrate and actually study the history and the consequences of the left-wing dreams policy. Given that reality, do you think we can win?
I think that we can win, but only if the left continues to be what it is clearly. And this is always the question. I don't think there's such a thing as permanently winning in politics. I think there's just, you win sometimes and you lose sometimes and you hope that you win more than you lose. I think the idea of a sort of political utopia where everybody agrees on the same sort of issues and there's a certain sort of broad baseline agreement, in the absence of an existential threat, it's very difficult to accomplish. The United States right now has no existential threats. During the Soviet Union, we did have an existential threat. And we recognized it as an existential threat. And so there was a pretty broad scale consensus on a certain hawkishness in foreign policy, a certain unwillingness to completely destroy our economy. And at the time, there was also some broad social consensus on the nature of family and the nature of what religious community should look like. A lot of that has dissipated, especially without that external threat. I think one of the things that I saw in Israel last time I visited is certainly greater unity than the first time I visited in 2001, or 2002, which was right after the first Intifada had begun. And the kind of marked shift in Israeli politics, wherein the vast majority of Israelis do have a sort of broad-based agreement on foreign policy, at least. And there's also been a market shift in terms of sort of free market economic thinking, at least on the right in Israel. I think a lot of that has been driven by existential threat and recognition of, as we say in the United States, what time it is. So I think that the United States has been living fat and happy for a while, and Joe Biden, I think, just removed his finger from the dike in terms of foreign policy. So we may get an existential threat sooner than we would like, unfortunately.
Do you think that the progressives are winning in part because of universal right to vote? In the past, only those who had property could vote. Now, the pendulum has swung towards the voting for all, including those who are living on government support. Do you think that there is a place for limiting the right to vote in order to fight the left?
I think it's a losing argument. I think that on an ideological level, there was always a baseline understanding in virtually every country that when you broaden suffrage in order to include people who are dependent on government largesse, they can vote themselves money, right? I mean, that has always been a serious, long-lasting problem and a subject of debate ranging from the United States to Great Britain. It was actually more of an issue in Great Britain than it was in the United States, because in the United States, it was so easy to obtain property because property was so widely available. We have an enormous country. Obviously, you know, frankly, I think that genie is out of the bottle. It's not going back in the bottle. And so the question now is, how do you mobilize groups of voters against particular issues in order to put together a majority? But I mean, on an ideological level, of course, there's truth to the fact that if you have a bunch of people who are dependent on welfare voting, they're all going to vote for more welfare. And this is a serious problem, particularly in a parliamentary system like Israel, where you can have groups that are literally just set up in order to gain the benefits. And so they will ally with whomever grants them the benefits. That bodes ill for the future of economic prosperity in Israel, for sure. There may be, you know, some moves that can be made in terms of lowering taxes, for example, in Israel, and cutting regulatory tape in Israel. But the social welfare state, which is really the giant burden in Israel and requires the taxes in the first place, that social welfare state is going to be very difficult to change or dismantle in any serious way, so long as Israel has entrenched parties that are rooted solely and specifically in welfare benefits.
And many publics that are living on the public money.
Yeah, I mean, listen, there's nothing new under the sun. There's a reason that Great Britain went into massive stagflation in the 1970s, and it was due to their massive social welfare state. Japan has been in economic stagnation for a decade and a half, two decades, because of the burdens of their social welfare state. Whereas, you know, countries that have reversed their social welfare states have seen over time increased prosperity and growth. And that includes Latin American countries like Chile, which is sort of the case in point of a country that reversed its own economic malaise. It moved all the way from communism toward a sort of free market capitalism in a lot of ways because of its move away from social welfare.
Yeah, the difference between Chile and Israel is that Chile agreed to be helped by Milton Friedman. And when Milton Friedman came to Israel and he told Menachem Begin, you should do this, this, and this, he said, oh, but we can't, the unions, they will fight back.
Right.
What policies do you think that could be implemented to help to slow down the moral decline that progressivism caused in the West?
I think there is sort of I think there's going to be reality that kicks in at a certain point. And I think, frankly, you're already starting to see reality kick in. Just demographically speaking, the fact is that progressivism is a philosophy that does not tend to generate healthy families and children. The notion that all sexual activity is moral equivalent or utilitarian is obviously not true. And not only is it not true, it has some pretty significant downstream effects demographically speaking. When the only people who are having kids in your society, as in the United States, are people who are religious, two generations from now, that bespeaks of a population that probably will be slightly more religious, actually, not anti-religious than what you see today. I think there's a real lack of fulfillment that you're seeing from a lot of people who are granted the premise that hedonistic sexual activity was going to be the be-all, end-all, and sexual self-identification was going to be the center of who they were. I think you're starting to see a real disillusionment with that, particularly among a cadre of young men in the West. Progressivism, Marx always suggested that capitalism bears the seeds of its own destruction. I think progressivism also bears the seeds of its own destruction in this way. The utopia that people were promised is not actually a utopia. In many cases, it's a morally confusing and psychologically disappointing dystopia.
Let's hope you are right. So what advice would you give for a student that is going to college and have a few weeks or a few months to read books? Which books would you recommend him to read in order not to be so influenced by the progressive professors?
So, I mean, frankly, I think that if you only have a few weeks to read something or a few months to read something, you should be reading summaries of philosophers rather than philosophers. That is kind of what I tried to do in, for example, The Right Side of History, where I sum up a lot of philosophical ideas inside of 220 pages, which sometimes is a better way to do it, in terms of sort of what the public is capable of reading. If somebody spends years reading it and then summarizes it for you, that can very often be better. I think that spending some time with C.S. Lewis, spending some time with Russell Kirk, and spending some time with Thomas Sowell for sure would be particularly useful. Henry Hazlitt, the famous economist in the United States, that'd be really useful. If you're up to it, reading some F.A. Hayek would be excellent on the economic front.
So thank you very much, Ben. It was a pleasure, and I'd like to talk to you again because you have much to give to the Israeli public sphere, and, as you give to the American public sphere.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.